Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, John Karsibayev.
Hi there, my name is Shireen Dagan. I'm an operating partner with Frog Capital. I've been in the tech industry for 25 plus years. Started off as an engineer and worked in the telecoms industry. Then started my own software business, selling software to very large mobile operators around the world, and built that business up over 10 years. Sold that in 2013. It was one of three successful exits in Europe, for which I won the Female Entrepreneur of the Year award back then. I then stayed for about 18 months with the acquirer. I morphed into afterwards to an angel investor, as well as I mentioned, operating partner with Frog Capital. So I sit on a number of boards, both of those that I've personally angel invested, and also two of Frog Capital investment companies.
Sure, and thanks so much for joining us on the Ivy Podcast and that brief overview. Very exciting journey you had quite so far, which, you know, I'm very excited to talk about a little bit further on the podcast today. Before we talk about your current role and your current life, I guess, as an investor, as an operating partner, tell us a little bit more about your background when you were the founder operator. What was that like? What were some of the motivations behind actually building something of your own?
Yeah, sure. So as I mentioned, I'd already been working in the industry for 10 years. And when I had the idea for my software company, at the time I was working on the latest technology at the time for mobile, which was 3G. Of course, we're now in 6G, so it sort of shows my age a little bit. But back then, this was all new, and we were going to essentially have all the services that we currently take for granted at that time was just a vision. And 3G was going to be the enabler technology for that. So I was one of very early engineers that worked on 3G radio and air interface. So I had a lot of knowledge about the technology. And of course, I could see that the whole myriad of services that was going to get delivered over these new air interfaces, and of course, 4G came later as well, and so on. And I knew this was going to be, you know, the revolution, shall we say, second revolution in mobile. I understood very early on that there was a gap in the market, that around the world, engineering teams were not familiar with these new technologies. They didn't know how to design networks. They didn't know how to operate them. Everything was very new. And there were no software products to help them do that. So I saw that gap in the market. You know, I wasn't one of these people that always wanted to own their business or anything. I was very happy with my career at Vodafone when I was working for their research and development. And I was, you know, progressing really fast through their promotion, shall we say, track. But as soon as I got this idea, I just couldn't get rid of it. And it was a constantly thinking about it, constantly thinking that, like, I really think there is an opportunity here and I could do it. And eventually I plucked up the courage and resigned from my job and went into the big bad world on my own, which was quite a scary decision, I guess, for me personally, because at the time, you know, I had two small kids, a mortgage and a husband, you know, the sort of the full works of a young family. And it was a pretty big decision, but it was taken as a family, you know, as a family decision. So my husband was supportive, and so I took the plunge. So that was kind of the pretext to starting my own business. And of course, over 10 years that I ran it, and eventually it was a successful company, it went through lots of ups and downs, and thankfully more ups than downs, but certainly I've had my share of fairly hairy situations during that journey.
Well, that's super exciting, and I can relate on so many levels, having gone through, you know, my own startup journeys as well. You know, not quite as massive of an exit as yours at Entrepreneur of the Year. That's super cool. I want to talk a little bit more about this, but in a sense, really, you know, finding the courage, finding the motivation to start something. It's, you know, something that I can't keep stop doing, I guess, you know, these days. It's, I guess it's in the DNA. And I, yeah, these days I try to control myself very, very hard in terms of working on some, basically on choosing what not to work on versus, you know, jumping into something. Because I think if you're wired that way, which you seem like you're exactly like that, you always have that drive propensity to just like jump into and start building.
That's right. That's very true. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's super cool. And just the early days of your startup when you were building the company, was that, just tell us a little bit about that, because usually I find that the most fascinating time for a lot of the founders that I work with these days, and even myself, where you're bootstrapping, you're trying to get, you know, as creative as possible, and you're just using whatever resources that you can get your hands on. Tell us a little bit more about that period.
Yeah, sure. So when I resigned, I was lucky because Vodafone needed me for a period of time. So I walked away with a consultancy project. So my first paying customer was Vodafone, but it wasn't related to the product that I wanted to build. So I knew it was just a short term, you know, sort of cash generator. But it helped a little bit to pay. I mean, it wasn't very much. It was just like, you know, £20,000, but it was helpful just to kind of pay for various things that I needed. So I did that on the side, but also I progressed and developed the product. And I also managed to, as you say, you beg and borrow and you get people to do stuff for free for you. So, you know, my husband is also an engineer. So he did stuff over the weekend, sort of developed some parts of the software for me. And I, you know, developed the software as well. And so effectively just getting the product, you know, to a stage where we could demonstrate our ideas. You know, I was very well aware that at the time, you know, I didn't have a track record. I hadn't built a company before. So to attract investment, I knew that I needed to show something to get the investors excited. So for me, getting to a, you know, a kind of an alpha version just to be able to demonstrate something was very important. So we managed to do that on literally a shoestring with not much money. And also the other thing that I worked on was building what I thought needed to be a reputable board. I was doing all this stuff intuitively, because back when I started was 2002, and in those days, like, you didn't have all the amazing, you know, support that entrepreneurs have today, right? You know, I'm based in the UK, so, you know, the best we got was just some business advisor, which frankly was terrible. So there was no incubator, there was no, you know, accelerator program. I mean, none of this kind of really existed back then. So you were pretty much on your own. But I knew intuitively that I needed to bring people who had, you know, a great reputation in the sector. So I was fortunate enough during my period at Vodafone to work for Vodafone UK's CTO. And it was quite a lucky coincidence that he decided to retire 6 months before I started my business. So when I started my business, I just managed to somehow get his mobile number from you're resourceful, right? Or you have to be when you're a startup. And I just called him and said, hey, I've got this, what is an alpha version, and I'd love to demonstrate it to you. And, you know, I would love for you to be somehow involved with the company. So anyway, I demoed the product. He loved it. And I asked him to become my chairman. of the boards. And so to be able to attract someone like him, who was a founding, one of the founding members of Vodafone, was just amazing, to get someone like that on my board. And also I managed to attract another person who had ran all of British Telecom's research and development onto my board. And someone also, another person who had ran all of the corporate commercials for Vodafone, that essentially, like, I tried to get as many people that I felt could add credibility to me as a startup and as a person. And yeah, so that was kind of the early days of trying to put all of this together, develop the product, and search for money and try to raise what effectively was a seed round at that time. So yeah, those were the early days. Lots of hats, literally working like silly hours. I think I probably just slept maybe 4 or 5 hours a day or something like that, and worked 7 days a week, and whatever waking hour I had, I was either coding, I was either trying to fundraise, or I was looking after my kids and playing with them and trying to spend some time with them. So that was kind of it was a fairly hectic few initial years. Yeah.
Wow, that's super cool. A very inspiring story. And it's just, you're right. You know, during that time period, entrepreneurs didn't have, I guess, the resources and the luxury of, you know, the stuff that's available these days, where you see companies just blow up in a matter of a minute, just, you know, because of some of the resources that come at the disposal. And that, you know, just proves the point in terms of being able to be as creative as possible and just persevere through that period. I think that's very exciting. One thing that also really stood out, which I as I advise on this, you know, other startups as well these days, it's you mentioned that you also focused on building out the reputable board for your startup, because as you work to validate the product market fit, you try to get a few customers, and at the same time, you have to kind of build that little bit of credibility around it, because as a startup, you're no one. No one looks at you in your direction. Everyone just, you know, completely dismisses that. But it's such an important element of, you know, building the company from ground up at the very early stage. So I think that advice is, you know, still very powerful even these days.
For yeah, a lot of startups. I totally agree.
Yeah.
I mean, my board was amazing. In fact, they were the guys who gave me the initial seed money that, you know, enabled me to hire a couple of people. My husband could leave his job, and, you know, we could just completely focus on product development. And then I could put all my energy into selling the product. It was definitely, I completely agree with you. That advice definitely stands even today. Yeah.
Right. No, that's great. That's awesome. So I'm pretty sure you and I can spend the rest of the podcast talking about this, which, like, I really, really want to. But at the same time, I want to cover some other aspects of kind of that journey that you went through. So as you exited and you, you know, sounds like you had a very successful exit, and you also, the award that you received, which is absolutely outstanding. Your decision to kind of pivot and go into angel investing and venture capital seems like a natural progression in terms of, I'm in a similar path as well, not as grand as yours, but at the same time, taking the lessons from that period as a founder operator, and then going into the role where you help others in terms of lessons learned that you went through, some of the things that you did, maybe things to avoid. Talk to us a little bit about that progression or that decision to go into more of a mentor, advisor, investor versus trying to build something else again.
Yeah, sure. It's a really good question, because after I left the acquiring company, I actually took a year off, right? I wanted to spend time with my kids and actually go to sports days, you know, that they had in their schools, and actually be able to attend
all the days you've missed, right?
Exactly. And watch all the videos of them growing up because I missed that as well. So, I needed time to do that and spend time with my mom and, so just do the family stuff. And the thing that happened with me personally was that, you know, my mom was diagnosed with dementia on that year that I took off. I had no idea about this disease or anything. And of course, I found out more and I learned more about it. I knew that this was going to get worse, progressively with her. And really from early on and knowing, the marathon of starting a company and building it, and I knew what it took and what level of personal sacrifice and commitment that takes. And I knew I couldn't do that with my mom in that state. I would have absolutely loved to do another one. like in my heart and bone, I wanted to have another, build another company. But I knew that I didn't know how long I was going to have with her. So I didn't want to lose those years as well. Then I thought, okay, so what, how do I reinvent myself, right? I think that's also the other part of it, that when you sell your company, you don't just sell your company, you sell your identity. I know that the entrepreneurs who've sold their businesses, they would relate to what I'm saying, because it's part of you, and that, when that's taken away, you almost feel lost. And I felt lost for a few years, if I'm being really honest. I wasn't sure what was going to really satisfy me to the same level that, building a company, because there's nothing more amazing than building a company. And, how could I ever be able to get the same satisfaction? So I started looking at angel investments, and also I started looking at becoming chair of a board of a younger company. So there were sort of A series, and helping other entrepreneurs. And of course, when you're going from a full-on executive, and you're the decision maker and you're the one who's driving everything, and transitioning to somebody who would then support another entrepreneur, it's a completely different thing. And I knew it was different, and I didn't know whether I would be able to do it, because the danger was that I would still feel like I'm the CEO and take over, right? There's always a danger to when you're moving to kind of a non-exec chair or more of a mentor role. So that was a bit of an unknown for me, but I wanted to try it because I really personally enjoyed working with my both chairman, and later on I had a chairwoman. And I thought they were absolutely instrumental in my own personal development, but also really... I use them as role models to how to make sure that the board is aligned, because one of the, I think, the most important success factors for any company is an aligned board, right? Especially if you've got investors and you have different investors coming in at different stages. You may have some conflicting, perhaps, goals, etc. And it's really critical, I think, as a chair, to be able to bring the executives and those investors together, so everyone kind of drives in the same direction for the same goal. And I wanted to do that. I became... first, an executive chair, because there needed to be quite a lot of help with the company. And so that gave me the kind of a halfway buzz that I wanted. but then I felt that really, if I'm going to be successful as chair, that I need to be able to get the founder CEO to a point where I can actually step back to a non-exec chair. And for me, if I could do that, then I considered that as my success, and I'm really happy to report that I did that. And so, essentially, I was executive chair for about 18 months, and then helped the founder CEO hire a really amazing executive team, and you know, gradually put looked at strategy change. Basically, did a lot of the things that you know I did for my own business, and then once I knew everything was going, and he was really fantastically stepping up to the job, and knew you know. Comes almost like mentoring him. Then I felt it was a good time to step back to a non-exec chair role, and then I understood that I could actually do that role, which was a great feeling actually, and I really enjoyed it. Today I'm chair of four companies, so I'm actually you know doing it with other folks as well, and so far so good.
Yeah, that's wow. That's quite interesting. And as you join a lot of the boards, that brings me to another point that's very, very, you know, it's a touchy subject, because the whole concept of a value add investor, that we hear that on a daily basis, everyone, you know, labels themselves as a value add investor. But there's a different sentiment from the founder, startup, you know, CEO community, where they almost view the venture capital, angel investing space where, you know, it's almost a full-time job, number one, when you do the fundraising, but then also being able to really find that type of partner who is really capable of helping you just beyond that financial support. Yeah. And I think that's, you know, there's very few that really grasp that concept when it comes to from the investor standpoint. Tell us a little bit more about that. What are your thoughts on the whole, you know, concept of a value add investor, and how do you see a genuine value coming from whether angel investors or the VCs that can really help these startups grow and scale?
Yeah, I mean, obviously because I've been on the other side as well. So as a founder CEO, when I raised money, I personally really appreciated investor who had been an operational person before, and I felt that that person added a huge amount of value. So I think thankfully these days we do have a lot more VCs who either themselves have been operators, founders, etc. Prior to their VC career. Or they have an operating partner program like Frog does, which I think is a really interesting way of doing it. So they sort of take the best of the VC, you know, best practice, and also the private equity best practice. So they have a sort of operating partner program where, you know, there are specific disciplines you know, you go in and you try to help companies that, you know, or portfolio companies that you have. I mean, my sort of thing about this is actually really quite simple. I think advice to CEOs or founders who are raising money is that, I mean, the most important thing I think is chemistry with the investor, right? Do really get on with them? Do they really believe in your vision? I think that's critical. Some say they do, but do they really? Because in that journey, there's going to be some really tough spots. And if they don't believe in that vision, if they don't believe in what you're doing and believe in you, you know, then I think that would be a recipe for disaster. So I think those things, chemistry and whether they really believe in the vision, I think are two top ones. And of course, if they have built a business themselves in the past, I think that is hugely valuable to have on the board. You know, not because, you know, ultimately as non-execs, as board members, you know, we're not going to be able to do the doing for the entrepreneurs, but because we've had different experiences, we can bring different ways of looking at a problem. And I think the other part of it is that because we've been on the other side and we understand how hard it is to operate a business and how hard it is to keep growing at 100% year on year, and every quarter you have to hit those numbers that keep going up and because we've been in that shoe. We know how stressful that is, not just for the founders, but for everybody in the company. When there is a problem, then I think value add investors who've been in the shoes of the founders and the executives, they actually try to help solve the problems rather than just beat them up, which is, you know, sometimes happens, unfortunately. So I personally think there is now a lot more value-add investors out there who are former entrepreneurs, former operators, or they realize that they're not, and they actually, you know, have a set of people that they work with to be able to put at the disposal of their portfolio companies, which I think is hugely valuable.
Yeah, that's a great point, especially something that stood out in terms of being able to find that right partner with whom you can, you know, essentially they believe in your vision, but someone you can actually get along with very well, because in that journey, you're probably going to be with them for the next 10 years at least. And if you can't have that very open dialogue, especially when times get tough, that's when the true colors come out. I think that's super important that, you know, I try to pay very close attention to that, especially at the very beginning when you're starting to get to know the founding team, the founders, before you even start talking about the market, the product, and all of that great stuff. Because at the end of the day, it's kind of part of the overall evaluation strategy when you decide to whether invest or get involved with a particular startup. So when we talk about that founder market fit, when you meet the CEOs, the founders of startups, what are the additional things that you look for when it comes to identifying a prospect that you think has greater chances of succeeding as a founder? What are some of your evaluation metrics when it comes to founders?
Yeah, I mean, I think the standard ones everyone knows, you know, you try to assess whether the person is open to different ideas and suggestions and advice. Are they going to, you know, listen or just completely ignore anything that anyone tells them? So, you know, the ability to listen, I think, is really important. Working with founders who are self-reflective is, I think, very important. Somebody who realizes that they don't know what they don't know. And they also realize that this is a journey and they need to grow with a startup, with their business, and different stages would require them to almost reinvent themselves. I think part of the being an entrepreneur is not just being an entrepreneur and actually creating a product and creating a new market, but actually you have to create yourself too as the different stages come along. And so that's important, the ability to grow. And also, I think for me personally, and you know, when I do my own personal angel investments, I try to find out about the entrepreneur's background. I think that's really, for me, it's really critical. I mean, I actually ask questions about their childhood, their upbringing, and you might think that's very strange, but I find that those who have something to really prove, they're super dedicated and super driven. And so when I hear really interesting backgrounds, when I hear really interesting and sometimes even tough backgrounds, I actually think to myself, okay, you've been through some tough gig, right? So I think you're going to make it. And you know, as an investor, you especially an angel investor, you know, you want somebody who has unbelievable tenacity. Because this does take a lot of strength, both mentally and physically. So you want to make sure that, you know, the founders you're backing have that in them.
Yeah, I love what you said about getting to know the early days of the founder, which I absolutely agree with, and I try to spend a lot of time understanding, especially, you know, the high school and the college days. Were you like, did you join a club or did you form a club? Or, you know, were you like, were you the navigator or were you the cartographer? Like, did you create the actual maps for others to follow and so forth? And I think those are such, you know, very unique perspectives to be able to understand that type of personality and the role they play in the startup. I think that's, you know, that's super important. And unfortunately, you know, not a lot of VCs or angel investors spend a lot of time there and focus a little bit more on, you know, the size of the market or, you know, the potential exit and things like that, which those early predictors, early behaviors of the founder, I think those are like, those are number one in the scorecard when you try to evaluate potential opportunity. And from a standpoint, as you move on and you evaluate the founders and you try to help the company validate, you know, look from a lens of that PMF, that product market fit, and understand some of those early predictors, whether there is a demand for that service or solution or not. Tell us a little bit more about that. What are some of the things that you look for when you evaluate a particular product from that perspective?
Yeah, so speaking, as operating partner within Frog. So Frog Capital is a Series B investor. So by the time we look at companies at that stage, they already should have product market fit. So there should be data available, you know, customers, we can see cohorts. So, you know, there should be a lot of data for us to make that assessment that there's genuine product market fit, and we look for indicators like renewals, churn, you know, LTV CAC, you know, the sort of the standard things that you will look at, sort of Series B. And of course, market size becomes critical at that point. But as always team is, you know, number one, right? We look at, you know, do we believe in this team? Do we feel that this is the team that's going to take it from Series B to, you know, a very large company, whether it's, you know, IPO or whether it's a trade exit, you know. So Series B, I would say there's already a lot of data and you can assess product market fit, I would say, more easily. From a standard point of view of angel investment, and that's pretty hard because normally as an angel investor, so I'm a member of Cambridge Angels. We're a prominent angel group in the UK. So one of the famous ones. And the thing that, you know, we tend to see, or the companies we tend to look at, are very early stage, most of the time pre-revenue. So it's all about people and vision almost. You know, we could get, I personally, for example, invested in a company where I literally just saw a prototype with wires hanging out of it. And that's what they had. And there was no products. It was just, you know, an idea. But I really loved the team and I loved the vision and what they wanted to do. And and market size seemed large enough. So let's go. I think that's about as much data you can get very early stage. And so far, you know, touch wood, I haven't done too badly in picking the right companies to invest in, I guess, in both series. So I hope that answers your question, but it's a tough one. The product market fit is a tough area, but depends on the stage of the business you're investing at.
Right. No, yeah, absolutely. And there's no specific formula for that either. It's, you know, there's some certain indicators that can tell you, yes, there is some type of demand, whether there's, you know, some type of a sign up list for a particular service, or you've conducted certain, you know, number of interviews with prospects and they've expressed certain interest in that. But overall, it's, you know, it's a challenging aspect, because at the end of the day, it's how you also evaluate whether there's true value in the service. I follow you, you know, some of the posts that you've recently made or posts published about, you've written a little bit about the pricing strategies for startups and the products and technology in general. Share with us your thoughts on the overall kind of the pricing strategy when we talk about technology products or anything that's SaaS related from that standpoint. What are some of the pitfalls to avoid? Because it's not easy, and it's a science, but at the same time, it's an art as well. So talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, you said it exactly. It's both a science and an art. I mean, I think pricing is actually one of the hardest, but also one of the most important things that you could do in a startup, because it ultimately determines your market size. I think there are different things that come into pricing. So what you need to do in order to determine your pricing, I think, is to have a really good understanding of the value you deliver to your customer. I think that's a very important part of pricing. Understand what value you're delivering, and of course the customer needs to confirm that's the case. You can sit and think, I'm delivering 10 million a year value or savings or whatever to my customer, but if the customer doesn't believe it, it doesn't matter. So I would say that you've got to kind of really prove either a hard, ROI, whether that's through savings or whether that's through revenue generation, whatever it might be, and put a dollar value on that. Because that then starts determining, okay, how much can I charge for this product, right? So if I'm providing a certain value X per year to my customer, is it legitimate that I charge 20% of that, for my software, for example, per year? Perfectly so if the customer believes that that's the case, and they would be very happy to pay for that. However, you start hitting issues with pricing when you have essentially competition coming in. And of course, if your competition decides that they can do it much more efficiently and drop their price below what you were thinking, then, and you don't have what I call a critical USP, a unique selling point that you can, say to your customer base that for these reasons, I'm far better than my competition, and therefore I can justify the higher price, then I'm afraid the price essentially goes down to the lowest denominator in the market. And that's the tough, and that's when, you get into a sort of commoditized market, because everyone's doing it. So really, pricing, I would say, is a function of the value you're delivering. Obviously, a function of cost, right? Because you have to make sure that your customer acquisition cost is. I have a rule of thumb. So if your LTV CAC, LTV divided by CAC, is 3 or better, then you're on the right track. I think if it starts going below 3. Then you really need to look very, very hard at what you're doing, because I think that's when you get into really tough spots on profitability and so on. I'll give you a really simple example because I went through pricing twice during my startup for my first product and my second product. My first product, we priced, high at the beginning, and but we had a competition that was willing to basically sell it at a quarter of the price and even lower, and it meant that the market size as a result sort of shrunk from what we were thinking was a 250 million market size. It shrunk to about 50 million, and because we were selling to the telecoms industry, the cost of acquisition is actually significantly high, simply because you have to hire your own sales team, and you have to, because it's all about, enterprise sale, et cetera, et cetera. And when your average selling price is low, the CAC LTV just didn't make sense. It was like 1.5. And, it was pretty obvious that only one company was going to was going to be able to be successful in that kind of a market. Whereas in my second product, when I brought that one into market, because we were the first ones to market, first of all, we could set the pricing. So we weren't being dictated by our competitor, which was fantastic. But also the thing that a lesson was, and we did this, is we set the price high, because that's where you need to start, because the only way to go is down. Or at least that's usually what happens. So we set the price very high, and we kept it there because we could demonstrate the value we were adding to our customers. And it's very tough because, you know, when the customer looks at you in the eye and says, no, I don't want to buy it at that price, I want half of it, I want to, you know, I want a 50% discount, and you're still a small startup, and you're like, oh my God, you know, I still got to make the payroll and so on. It's very tempting to just say, oh, okay, you know, there's 50% discount, but we didn't do that. We were very, very strict on our price, and we believed in the value we delivered. So we stuck to our pricing, and that resulted in the fastest growth that was happening in my company. So, you know, we were literally growing like 80 to 100% a year. But that was because of really the pricing that we adopted and how strict we actually stuck to it. But we were lucky. We didn't have competition until 2 years later. And even then, we were so far ahead that even the competition was really, really cheap. We could say, well, fine, you can go and buy from cheap, but then they haven't got all these deployments, and, you know, you're going to spend the next 2 years helping them develop their products. So if you want to do that, that's fine. Or if you want something that works now, this is the price. So it's a, as you said, it's a science and an art. But my summary would be: focus on the value you're delivering to the customer. Work out the lifetime value that you can extract from a customer. Look at your cost of acquisition, and make sure that that's you know, that ratio works. Otherwise, you don't have a business.
Yeah, absolutely. And would you summarize that also for founders and startup, you know, operators, that it's also kind of almost an experimentation game as well when it comes to some of the pricing strategies, because a lot of that also depends on kind of the potential customer feedback or whatever the market conditions are. And it's challenging, because I see that a lot these days, especially when you think you have the right strategy for when it comes to pricing, and you have to pivot. I guess that's, you know, goes back to the point of, you know, founders that are able to be very agile from that perspective. What are some of the trends that you're very excited about these days? What are some of the things that, you know, you research yourself, some of the things that you're looking forward to, something that you're looking to invest in? What keeps you up at night these days?
Yeah, I mean, I look a lot at sort of genuine AI companies. I know everybody wants to have those acronyms, you know, in their investment deck, but genuine application of artificial intelligence, I definitely like those. I am actually involved in one that's a stealth AI startup. So very soon we will unleash. Also, I love the whole area of digital health. So I've invested personally in a tele-rehab company, Neurophenix, fantastic company. We're just launched in the US, and they're doing really fantastically well. And COVID obviously has propelled all of this telemedicine to the forefront, clearly. I think a lot with employee engagement, mental health, those kinds of things, I think those are the areas that I get very excited about. And I think, you know, there's a huge amount that we could do on that. So I would say my interests are quite wide. I tend not to look at hardware, but that's just my preference is sort of on the software side. But yeah, I could basically summarize it into AI, genuine AI technologies, and you know, telemedicine, digital health, those things are of particular interest to me. I have recently started to look at, you know, some funky things like carbon removal and things that are to do with the environment. But that's more of a kind of a personal thing that I want to invest in that have a big social impact on the environment. And yeah, but I don't confess to know anything about it. So I tend to rely on my fellow Cambridge Angels who know a lot about chemistry and all this kind of wonderful stuff. So,
yeah. No, that's very interesting. And I love what you said about genuine AI, because you're right. It's those buzzwords, those acronyms are everywhere. Anywhere you look, everyone's got AI, everyone's got ML, RPA in their decks. But it's, you know, it's very distinct. And also, you've mentioned something on the kind of from carbon and the green technologies. I agree, and something I've been dabbing into myself lately from personal interest into nuclear, because it's a very different alternative source of energy. And especially, you know, Bill Gates has been writing a lot about that lately, and it has just that different connotation. Nuclear has very negative, and but it's an interesting kind of trend and vision into how just the planet can really benefit from nuclear to be able to reduce the impact of the carbon and everything else. So that's super exciting. When it comes to learning and that content diet that I like to call that, what do you consume on a daily basis? What are your sources of information, or what are your sources for learning? Share with us what's on your desk, or what's in your bookmarks.
Oh gosh. So right now I'm reading More Money Than God. So this is all about the hedge fund history. And I'm sort of at the, I think, page 5. So I'm still sort of early, early into that book. And I love, so just reading about history books. So the one other that I started reading is the History Politics of the World, which is trying to look at, you know, the last sort of 3,000 years and, you know, how as human races we got to here. So these are some of my interest areas. I'm not a person that reads novels. I tend to focus on more historical facts and things. But yeah, but right now I'm reading More Money Than God, which is seems very interesting. Interesting.
Yeah, we'll make those recommendations available in episode notes. And in conclusion, what is one book that you always recommend to others? Is there something that's distinct that really pops to your head that you're like, you got to read this book?
Yeah, so to entrepreneurs, I recommend Founder's Dilemma. I think that one is, I loved reading it myself, and I think it's important that any founder thinking about starting a company should read that. And also, the other one that I recommend is The Hard Things About Hard Things, I think.
It's Ben Horowitz, right?
Yes, that's right.
I love that book.
that book is fabulous. And you know, once I've actually written it, I recommend my own book. I'm in the process of writing it. So.
Oh, really? Nice.
Once it's written, I've been doing it for the last year. I'm embarrassed to say. So I try to find time to complete it. But yeah, one day it will be completed, it will be published.
Oh, that's super cool. And I know exactly what it takes to write a book. Recently, me and my colleague, We released a book on product and project management, mainly because that's our backgrounds. And we've been working on that for close to 3 years. And
oh, okay. I don't feel so bad.
And it's like you get into that writer's block, and then you get motivated again, and then different trends come up and you got to rewrite it. it's a vicious cycle. So I can relate on many levels what you're going through. Sharon, last but not least, how do you think this conversation went?
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. It took me back to some of the sort of, you know, startup days and reliving those. So that was fun. I really enjoyed it. Thank you so much for, giving me the opportunity to share my story. And hopefully it will be useful for those who listen to it. And I've had an amazing, you know, career. I'm extremely lucky to have gone through what I have, and I'm really looking forward to, I guess, the next chapter. Maybe in 10 years time, we'll sit down again and I'll tell you about all the exciting things I did over the next 10 years.
Well, that you beat me to the punch, because all of my guests, I usually tell them the same thing, in that we got to do another episode in a period of time and see how much you've changed, that we can listen to some of the things we discussed in 2021, and just see how much I've changed. So we really appreciate your insights today and your time. I personally learned quite a bit. So we'll stay in touch and we'll plan something in 10 years.
All right. Wonderful. Thanks a lot, Dan. Cheers.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.